Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Iron Hack Podcast. I'm DevOps Dan.
I'm Ternary Tim. How are you doing, Dan?
Very good. Very beautiful Saturday morning we're recording on this week. Good energy to be back in the sun after the long winter dark. I mean, it hasn't been yet, don't get me wrong. But
yeah, we're not out of the woods.
Yeah.
We had a very interesting guest on the show this week.
Yeah, it was a good conversation.
Yeah, we had Franziska Hauk. Franziska Hauk. She is the head of people at SAP, which is a huge tech company. Mm-hmm. And it was just information dense this episode,
yeah,
wasn't
it? We were talking a lot about like this people leadership and what is a people leader. But I think more importantly for the listeners, there was a lot of really good advice on what newcomers should look for, you know, coming in the industry and like what does and does not constitute, you know, good communication and good leadership in tech teams. And so it was very good. Unfortunately, we didn't get to cover one topic which we wanted to do today. So what we're going to do is have a follow-up episode in the later weeks.
It's a two-parter.
Yeah. So this first part is all about, you know, how is this people leadership structured, how they do it at SAP, a lot of Francesca's experience in that field. And also we talk about her community called Tech People Code. Yeah, which is a good one. But in the follow-up episode, we're going to dive a lot deeper into this diversity in tech teams and, you know, address the issue of underrepresented teams in the world of tech.
For sure. And I think this episode specifically is just great for getting, you know, like what to do in an interview, how to get to that interview point. Just, yeah, great. I mean, this would be the episode that I would listen to if I was just about to finish my boot camp. It's good stuff.
Yep. So enjoy the episode, get some good information, relax, get a drink, pen and paper maybe if you're about to start applying for jobs.
If you're motivated.
Yep. Otherwise, subscribe everywhere good podcasts are made, and we'll just let you enjoy the episode. Catch you on the other side.
Awesome. So who am I? My name is Franziska. I am based in Berlin, have been for almost a decade now, so quite a time. And in my professional life, I am principal people lead at SAP Signavio, and in particular in the Process Intelligence Engineering Group. And what is a people lead? That's a question that I get a lot. And what do you actually do, right? The terminology people lead often applies to HR people. So you, for example, when you lead an HR department or an HR team, that could be called a people lead. In our case, however, it's a dual leadership model. So that means that there are teams that are assigned to me. I'm the manager of those teams, usually 1, 2, 3. And I collaborate on the functional progression of the team members with a respective functional lead. So, for example, in those teams, there are engineers, for example, backend, frontend, full stack. We have designers as well. We have product owners. For the product owners, I collaborate with a principal product owner. For the designers, I collaborate with a principal design lead. And for the engineers, I collaborate with a tech lead or principal tech lead. So that way, people have kind of the best of both worlds, right? So they have a person who's fully dedicated to professional skills development, who takes the manager role. And yes, we do the admin stuff, all of that good stuff, like hiring, headcounts, promotion, salary rounds, etc. And then they also have a person that they work with on a daily basis, functionally, that gives them guidance, that invests into their functional progression, or you could say technical progression as well. So it's a multilateral system of tandem leadership, you could call it. Yeah. And therefore, this is the way we live dual leadership. There are other forms, of course, as well. But this is how we have set up the model to be. And I actually did write about how that's defined on my blog as well.
Nice. Is that more of like a, I mean, because SAP is a very big company. Mm-hmm. Do you think people should expect to see that across the board? Because I don't think I've ever come across it in my time working in small companies.
And actually, that's something that's, I wouldn't say it's very common or widespread, but there are quite a lot of people leads. In fact, recently there was a group set up by German-speaking people leads. And there are a couple of companies, what comes to mind, Atrubia, I heard. There was also Fiducia, or however you pronounce that. So there are a couple of companies that actually live that model. Hyperport was also one where that was lived. And there are different models and different ways of living that people leadership system, right? Mm. But in that group alone, I think there are about a little bit over 100 people leads now.
Okay.
And if I were to count all of the primarily English-speaking people leads in Germany to that group as well, then a couple of hundred at least in the, let's say, the tech ecosystem in Germany. So that would be my rough guess. And what I have seen is that when companies decide to go for a model, they have that model and they implement it in their structure, right? And we, for example, at SAP Signavi, we actually have two structures. We also have development manager, so what you would consider to be the classical engineering manager. Mm. But it depends a little bit on the environment, what your motivation is, where you want to go with this. And I also say there are a lot of people out there that are like, this method is the best, this method is the best. I would never say that. It's always check your organization, see what is your strategy, what is your objective, what do you want to achieve with that? And then leverage the model that you think is the best for that mission, right? So you could see the classical engineering manager system. There are also other systems of people leadership and tech. So there often I find that you have sort of an inherent people lead structure because you have a manager, for example, who oversees several teams. And then maybe she has one team lead who is technically a team lead, but doesn't have manager responsibilities, right? It's a little bit of a pick and choose sometimes, and you take the best out of the world that you want to have for your system and for your model. What I do recommend, though, is that when you go for that, don't overcommit right away, right? Don't say, well, this is something we do, you haven't tested it out. Give it a try, see what leadership models work well for you. And when you are convinced of something, then you can implement it in the whole organization and provide a good definition of that people leadership model. Because when people come in, of course, there might be aspects that are new for them. So seeing a clear definition that says, yes, this is what the responsibility of that person, this is the responsibility of that person, this is what the roles are called, and this is how they collaborate, and these are the shared responsibilities, that is really, really important, so that there's orientation for new joiners or for people that have maybe lived and worked with a different system beforehand. But that's, I think, an essential part of strategy anyway, that you provide good definitions and you have a good communication strategy that follows that. And a good communication strategy for me is not that you change things and then you communicate once, but we all know that in particular in change management, communication has to be steady. It has to be repeated. It has to be sent via various channels. And particularly when circumstances are changing, when conditions are changing, you also have to, again, repeat the communication. That's very important and essential. So there is no philosophy that's the best or the best approach that generally exists. What I say is look at your organization, look at the needs, and look at what could fit that organization.
Yeah. Because we kind of wanted to talk today specifically about people who might have graduated, from their boot camp. And I think it's a really interesting insight because I don't know. I think that kind of like, especially that point about communication and making sure that the channels within a company are very clear. I think that's definitely something that people maybe it's good advice to sort of ask about that in interviews, because I think if you kind of had this, if you wanted to know about the management style and how the teams interact with each other, how the communication is within teams, I think that's actually that's definitely something I would take into an interview to ask these days. I think when I first graduated, I was just like, give me a job. but I think that would be kind of, definitely would be a question that I would ask these days for sure.
Well, what kind of red flags are you looking for with that question? Like what's a good rule of thumb for a good answer to how do you communicate internally, Tim, that was directed at you.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
If you're asking the question of like, how do you communicate internally? What are you looking for like a good or a bad answer? What warrants good communication?
I think, just from Francisca's answer there, it was, you were very clear about it. I think there's a lot of companies where it would be like, well, we have a lead and you could report to them. And then, you do a review sometimes. We just talk on Slack, there's docs. You know, I think just from that little introduction that Francisca did then, it's just, it's so like crystal clear of like, this is how it works. I think you'd probably just expect like that level of answer as opposed to just vague.
That being said, that's also a misconception that I find very often, that leaders have everything together and they always know what to do and so forth. No, there are, of course, changes that happen and you have to adapt. I think the difference of the difference between a bad leader and a good leader is that a good leader is reflective in that scenario. They question themselves, they challenge themselves, and they make sure that they provide reassurance and calmness to the team, right? Even if the if you go through the worst storm. Going back to that earlier point, I think to be 100% fair, when you start out in your career, it might very often be a situation of just give me a job, right? we've all been there. We've all done that. I can tell the same story. I was also, when I graduated from my master, I was just like, just give me a job and I'll get my first experiences. And then I can, you know, go on to do other things and conquer the world. So that might be a situation with the current climate and also the development that we've seen over the last years. It's not a common theme to see a lot of junior positions, entry-level positions out there. So there is a strong tendency to, in the first years, you might have to hustle, right? But what I appreciate a lot in candidates, and that is irrespective of seniority level, and by the way, not a lot of candidates, not a lot of applicants ask good questions in the interviews. But you interview me as your prospective employer as well. It's a two-way street. You have to get to know me so that you know, can we work together? Is this environment a good one for me? So you can, if somebody really is, has the intent to be like, oh yeah, our communication is awesome and everything's great and everything is going well all the time, then they will just say that, right? And it will be hard to see through that. But you can ask, let's say, a little bit more detailed on the areas that are important to you. If you appreciate good communication, you could, for example, ask about how are difficult decisions communicated. Do you have an example for me from the past?
That's awesome.
Has that happened recently? Have you ever had to, was there maybe a team split and it was complicated to do? Was there reorg? Reorg's very popular, of course, so definitely a good area to ask about. Have you ever had any challenging times in the team and how did you deal with that? How did you, check in with team members to see how they're doing? So everything in leadership and everything in collaboration is essentially about communication. So there's a wide array of questions you can ask. But if that's important to you, think about, before you go into the interview, what are my values? What are the things that I look for? What makes me thrive? And then derive the questions from that. And my recommendation is not to go in and be like, tell me, and be like, in your tone. But
are you bad at communicating?
You can make this a conversation. The best job interviews are conversations that happen between the prospective employer, whether that's people that you will collaborate with in the team or your manager or maybe other stakeholders in the interview process. And you have the right to ask your questions. That being said, I did put together a list of questions just as a means of inspiration. If you want to have a look at that, you can see, okay, that's important for me, so I will ask that question. And also an indicator, when we talk about green, orange, and red flags, an indicator and a very strong red flag is if the company gets angry or frustrated about the questions that you ask. If you come in and you're genuinely curious about something and they're like, oh yeah, and they're dismissive of you, is that a place that you truly want to work at? That is also a good question to ask. Again, we do see with recent layoffs and economic changes, we do see a little bit of a change. But when we look at the tech sector, the numbers in Germany indicate that the positions that remained open that companies couldn't fill goes up and up and up over the last years. So there is a high demand of that skill set. So you have power. And you can interview in turn. You should do that. And I personally, I like challenging questions in interviews. I'm not daunted by them. I want to have them. And I really appreciate if someone goes all in and is like, Francisca, no, tell me. I'm really interested about this part. I want to know about that. Can you tell me more about that? And I will try to answer as truthfully and as transparently as I can.
There is this fact that, like you said, of just giving me a job, of like this kind of fear, especially for first time interviewees, for the bravery to like push the prospective interviewer. And I think it's such a hurdle that people who are very good at interviews, you know, usually don't need the interview as much as the person who's, you know, 15 interviews in that week and they're looking for a job. It can be very difficult to do anything that might rock the boat, but it usually turns out as a positive, you know, as you just mentioned. Employers seem to appreciate it because it just shows that they're a bit more on the same page, they're paying attention. So, yeah.
Also, when you ask questions, it shows interest. If someone comes in the interview to me and says, Franziska, I read up on the company and I know about this bit and know about that, but that's impressive. Yeah. Mm. But if you truly identify for yourself, what do you want? And then you ask questions to me about that. And you also then engage with me in a conversation like, oh, that's interesting. I want to know more about that aspect. Great. Then I'm like, okay, this is a person that I know, or at least I observed that in the interview, that will start with us. And even if they don't have all of the knowledge or the picture perfect, you know, the list of bullet points memorized, then they will have a skill set where they have curiosity and where they will look at a challenge and try to break it down and then try to find the information that they need and to a certain degree educate themselves. I don't expect juniors to mentor themselves or train themselves by themselves, but the skill set is a very good skill set to have. And it's a very good indicator that there's a true and genuine interest to come to our company. That being said, I don't expect applicants to come into the interview like, I've always wanted to work for your company. It's my dream.
Oh my God, this is my dream. Yeah, this is my dream. Yeah.
Never wanted to go anywhere else. This is just not again, when you are just starting out and we are trying to get your first full time job, or nowadays part time is also very, very established and perfectly fine. You are starting out, so you will probably look at, I don't know, 40, 80, 100 companies, and the one of the first opportunities where you feel like, it's a match and they give you an offer, you will probably go for that. So again, it has to be a balance. If it goes into one end of the spectrum, it's probably not a good thing. Yeah.
I think from when we first started doing this podcast, I would have definitely said that the best approach would be to like have a list of companies that you've really worked on, you know, for juniors, that is, you know, have a list of companies that you've like, this is what I want to do. This is my list of like interests. These are the companies that match it, like a really refined list. And then just like apply to those. And then, so you can ask those questions like, you know, I've been really interested in this and, you know, how do you tackle this problem? Or I realize you changed this recently or blah, blah, blah. So it's, you're very, very engaged. But I think since we've been doing the podcast, I think it was very early in the proceedings that one of the very first interviews we did, where a guy came on who had this amazing quote of the spray and pray, which is basically just send out as many applications as you can and then just get as many interviews as you can.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think it's been half and half, like the success rate of people who have like done very, very like meticulous planning of like, I'm going to apply to these three companies. And then some people who are just like, everyone is going to get an application from me.
I mean, it's subjective though, right? In terms of like success rate, like that might work better to just send out 1,000 CVs, but it's a case of whether or not you just take companies that you really want to work for. But then obviously then the other factor of time and resources and how long can you keep interviewing for, and you know, beggars can't be choosers, I guess is the phrase. So it very quickly becomes a case of like, I'll just apply for everything. So
that's not advice though. Don't go and interview and say, look, I'm a beggar.
and you don't even have to feel that way, because you do have great skills and something great to offer. That's we are talking about a skills shortage all the time. It goes through the press. And yes, like in the last days, there was quite a lot of press about there is actually no skills shortage in Germany. That's not true. It depends on the area, the job area, and then the focus area. And for example, medicine and tech generally are very the fields where you do have a immensely high skills shortage. So you can come to the interview and you can go there and be like, I have something to offer. And yeah, that's definitely what you should do. What I also very strongly recommend is wherever you are in your journey, whether you are a university student or you're attending a boot camp or whether you're self-taught, network.
Yeah.
Start from the very first. And you can do that on various levels. You can do that within your learner/student community. Those will be the people that will later go on to have those jobs and maybe be able to recommend you into a company. Teachers, there are also companies that like to engage with education providers. So they set up events and possibilities to meet them. For example, there are recruiting days that you can attend. But most importantly, and maybe I say that because I steered communities of that nature, the tech communities are gold. They took a really big hit throughout the corona pandemic because meeting in person was difficult to do and is still very challenging to do. I speak from the perspective that I'm a chronically ill person. I have to isolate. I can't go to meetup at the moment. I can, but it's risk. It's a lot of exposure. And they're also very interesting and very, let's say, there are communities also that meet online and that do activities online as well. So I would say year 2023, it's a good mixture. And there are also communities that are a bit more geared towards, let's say, the junior end of the spectrum. So definitely good. So go to those meetups, join those online communities. Engage with people, talk to people, introduce yourself, be on the lookout. There are job channels sometimes in online communities. I have a couple of recommendations for that as well. So there are possibilities to not only sit in your room at home and, you know, map through companies, but to go out there and meet people that work at those companies at your prospective employer. And also when I talk about Germany is heavily decentralized. So that big employer that has that shiny image might not always be the employer that has the really interesting and intriguing junior positions where in the first years you can already get your hands on really exciting projects. It might be worthwhile to just, again, connect with people locally at events. To take a look at what are the tech oriented companies that are in my local area, and maybe that is an aspect that I can check out, and then send initiative applications, right? Just send it there. And with one caveat I have to add, when we talk about, you know, sending out to hundreds of companies, if you do apply for a job in a specific area, and you have a generic CV because you cannot adapt the CV all the time, just make sure that it's so, let's say, applicable to the position generally. I've had CVs that stated things and missions that were absolutely different from the posting. So that's also a very important thing to do, to sort of have a last quality check before you send that off. But again, it's about a balance. I don't expect candidates to adapt CVs specifically to the individual positions, and then you have to write a cover letter on top. That might be helpful. It can provide context, particularly when you can detail what it is that you are looking for and how we, for example, can provide that. That's great. I personally don't read cover letters. If I do read them if they're attached. Yes, I do. If people invest the time, I will read the cover letter.
Just burn them.
But I don't demand it anymore, because again, this is tech, and you know, CV is enough. Just give me the download something from LinkedIn. Good. But I do know that there are a lot of hiring managers out there that have a different view, and they want to have that cover letter, particularly in the first years of your career, because then they can see from what you write, why is it that this is the position that's interesting for you. So to summarize, there are lots of avenues to explore. And networks, communities hold true treasures. There are potential mentors to be found there. There are potential employers to be found there. Just community and companionship. You're not alone, right? Oh, that puzzling problem, I don't know how to solve that. Talk to people. Yeah. And then there's a lot of recommendation open source. Just contribute to open source, and then you will get like a profile. I find that to be a little bit of a challenging advice to give, because we have, for example, single dads that don't have time to do that. We have people that take care of elderly relatives, right? So it's it's not always possible to have that time and the resource to invest into that. It can be one of the avenues that you can explore.
On that open source note, though, I just wanted to kind of dive into that a little bit, because it's not something we talk about very much. I think the networking and kind of going to meetups and community is something that a lot of people advise. But I think, the open source, contributions. And I was watching a video that you posted about it, actually being able to find mentors by basically contributing to open source projects. And I think it's, for people that maybe can't go to meetups, or they can't, for whatever reason that might be, might just not be their thing, I think that's a really interesting avenue. I think it would be definitely something that I would advise, or mention more, when speaking to sort of graduates, because I think, if it's open source and you can do a pull request and you can see that the pull requests are getting comments, then, it's a really open place to start writing code and getting feedback. And it could be like a good avenue if you're looking for that direction, a little bit less, in person, because not all the being a good developers do want to be, that socially active.
and not to forget, particularly over the last 2-3 years, and that might be correlated to Corona and less meetups happening in person, I saw that a couple of companies have expanded their footprint in sponsoring people in the world of open source. So okay. We do see that popping up more and more. And by the way, someone who is a big proponent of that strategy is the Eddie Hub community. So shout out to Eddie, absolutely great in supporting juniors and motivating them to keep going. Through his content, I was made aware of so many more possibilities and opportunities. But that being said, once I was aware of that, I did spot more companies that go with the sponsorship model. So I'm not saying, you're a junior, you start open source and then you will be, sponsored by this great company right away. Might not happen. So I want to be cautious in my advice here. But we do see that this is an avenue that gets more and more attention and more investment over time. Yeah.
Nice.
So tell us a little bit about this Tech People Code that you are involved in. Can you give us a little summary of what exactly that is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's my hub for all things human and tech. Okay. And that's essentially what is in the title already. You could look at the title as Tech People Code coming together, right? But also Tech People Code, as in the activity, Tech People Code, but also as in the...
Right, yeah.
Tech People Code and how to crack the Tech People Code. So I found that title to encompass a lot of the things that I do and practice.
Nice. That's a very well thought out title.
Yeah. When you asked about it, you probably didn't think that there was this big long story. But there's always a sense in these kind of things. And I started the hub in 2020 when I had started my position at SAP Signavio. Back then, we were still Signavio. We integrated into SAP, by the way. So I went through an acquisition in the last years. Because I had, particularly in the people lead position, I had things that there were sometimes new to me, or I tried myself out, I was experimenting. And coming from the world of community and a bit of social media, I also did a bit of comms in the past, lots of project management. There was always this tradition and this expectation that you also do good and speak about it, experiment and speak about it. So get that content out there, get that the thought process out there. So I started that hub, and also that coincided with me starting my coaching and mediation qualification training. And it has become my avenue for tips and tricks for people in the tech industry and adjacent fields. And now I would say the people that read my articles are mostly recruiters, HR business partners in the world of tech, engineering managers and engineering leaders, juniors in the tech industry as well, developers that want to develop their career. So this is kind of the mix of people that I also interact with on a daily basis in my work, and that I want to detail my thought process to, and then engage with this community and see what are their ideas. Are they trying out different approaches? How have approaches worked for them? And how can we learn together collectively, right? So, but most importantly, I started independently of Gregory Orfosch, but what he said about, I write about what I like and what is fun for me. Yeah, I support that. That is exactly, because when you do that, you're passionate and you pour your heart and soul into the content. So yeah, that's my path and my hub for people in the industry and adjacent fields to learn, to grow, to develop themselves and to, yeah, have conversations with me and develop our practices further.
Yeah, nice. Well, I've been looking at some of the posts that you've made. I think we've actually touched on quite a lot of the topics already. And there was just, it's really interesting. I think one of the interesting posts that you sent on LinkedIn was this sort of like diversity around locations in Germany. And I think just opening discussions around that and actually showing people that there are different options. I think it's really fascinating, especially for juniors, because it might be kind of like just thinking, I've got to move to Berlin. I've just got to start, I've got to join a company there. Because I mean, that's what, you know, especially coming from the UK, that's what it's like. It's just like Manchester, Birmingham, London, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Maybe Cardiff. I don't know if I'd go there.
Edinburgh, surprisingly, I found has quite a good, let's say, compared to the size of the city. By the way, I lived in Edinburgh for a while, so... definitely a city of my heart, but yeah, you do have a lot of positions there compared to the size and then the focus of the community. But I looked at the UK numbers marginally as well, and it was fairly evident that almost everything happens in London, right? So
yeah. It's like unavoidable when you live there.
Yeah.
The gravity of London.
Germany has always been different. There is definitely a different nature to different regions. You have to underline that as well. And it's more challenging in Germany to find a job that's English speaking primarily, that's not in, let's say, the larger cities. It's fairly easy in cities like Berlin, Munich, Hamburg, Frankfurt to a certain degree. And then when I look at the numbers, Stuttgart, for example, has a really large tech community locally. But the corresponding number of jobs that are English speaking, I find to be less, much less than in Berlin. So this whole idea of when you are primarily English speak, at least in the working world, primarily English speaking developer, you go to Berlin, that is actually what is the lived reality in most cases, because you have the opportunity to have a career with that as well.
Yeah.
What used to happen a lot in Germany was that Germany, being a country with a strong investment into STEM subjects, you had lots of people moving here and then they learned German. And then they worked in German over time or started working in German right away. And, you know, over time, their German got better. And this has changed in the last decade, maybe one and a half decades, the last one and a half decades. So it is much more possible nowadays that you move to Germany and you don't even have to speak a word of German. Maybe, you know, for going shopping and small scale interactions when you are
just expecting. Enough to get by.
Everything else is in your English speaking, like you build up an English speaking ecosystem. And that used to be different. And also when you go to, let's say, more rural regions, I call it rural, but it isn't. I recently had a conversation with someone who works in Paderborn, which, like, who has heard of Paderborn outside of Germany, right? So I was like,
but
you have several thousand developers there locally, and to get a job in English there, probably not very likely. And you also don't have that breadth of choice. So you might have, I think there's a very strong Java ecosystem there locally, if I'm not mistaken. So that's one of the things where, yeah, if you know Java, if you like Java, you will probably find a job with that. Whereas with Rust, for example, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe someone comes up to me and says, Franziska, here's a company that works with Rust.
And then, only, you know, German-speaking Rust-based company.
I always like to learn. Please tell me if there is. By the way, we work with Rust at SAP Signavio Process Intelligence. We have teams, database engineering, that work with Rust. But it depends a little bit on the local landscape, what you can do, where you can go, what the opportunities are. But the general, let's say, blueprint jobs that you would find that you would generally also find in the larger cities, we will find there as well. And what I have seen is a lot of the trailing spouses category, not that I like that terminology, but where, for example, one spouse gets job in somewhere off of Berlin, and then the other spouse ends up also getting a job in that same area or same company. And it is possible. It is possible. It's doable.
Trailing spouse. That's a very funny turn of phrase, isn't it? Trailing spouse.
Good band name, isn't it?
I'm just a trailing spouse. Sorry.
Yeah, don't mind me.
Yeah. But I was on that topic of the language barrier. Actually, I was reading something recently about people moving from being mid-level to senior developers, and people were saying that it's actually very overlooked that if you are looking to, especially if you're moving outside of the job that you currently work in, if you want to like level up, then actually, and you've spoken English or German only in your professional career, actually learning that like other language could be the thing that would push you, the ability to actually move up in your career, because, as you get more senior, being able to speak to more people, and especially just gives you a wider breadth of companies to apply for, something I hadn't really considered before. I don't know if I would. I mean, my learning German story is not going very well. And I'm not sure whether like a more senior position would be the thing that would push me into learning it. I don't know.
But also, even if like you were learning German, learning to live and work and talk in German now, working in German would still be a whole different atmosphere for you to work in, so it's a long way off whichever way. Even if you were speaking fluent German every day with your partner and your friends and stuff, to get to that business German level it's going to take years of like day to day, it's a really complicated, a really annoying problem.
And Tim, when you were describing that, something came to my mind. The mid-level to senior jump is indeed one of it's one of the most debated ones and one of the most coveted ones as well. What I have seen a lot is that opportunities open up more strongly in the junior bracket when you know German. Why? There are a lot of tech consulting companies in Germany that have customer contact, even for people in development roles. And knowing German can get you into those junior positions. I have several examples, and this is something that when I did a freelance work a couple of years ago and I interviewed companies, particularly for junior and entry-level positions, one of the most frequent things that came up, and by the way, I interviewed mostly in Western Germany, sort of off-center companies. And one of the things was like, if only they knew German, then we could hire them. Like the technical skills, even if they're not super great, we can get them there, but we need them to know German. And I think once you have that senior label, and that's also when we cannot debate the quality of recruiters or go down that path, which I don't want to open too much, but there is, you immediately unlock more opportunities for you once you have that senior label on your CV in some shape or form. Right? Once that is there, then you technically you get jobs thrown at you, and you have loads of messages every week from recruiters. And there I see a little bit more flexibility in the knowledge of German. Why? Because once you're considered to be a senior and you have that knowledge level and that impact, and you maybe are also able to mentor then the next generation of people coming in, then all of a sudden the German requirement is not that important anymore. Mm. So I think it's a mix. And again, it depends on location. It depends on mission. It depends what the company's looking for or what they're looking for and don't write into the job ad and don't tell you, right? But I would say German is a much stronger point at the beginning of the career. That's my observation. There might be other observations that are floating around. And essentially when you get to staff and principal level, you don't have to worry. Then it's just a question of money, right? It's just like, how much? But once you're there.
You're going to hire me. Just how much are you going to give me?
then it's just it's a simple situation of how high can you go? Why? Because we have seen a lot of people over the course of their career go into then more product-oriented roles and more management, because of course management is the end all and be all, and I'm doing that in quotation marks right now for those that cannot see what I'm doing at the moment. But yeah, so engineering as a field is still a very young field in comparison. So you don't see a lot of people over 50, over 60. By the way, I did have interviewers, and I do have people in that age range that reported to me at one point or other. But it's still the vast majority of people, and that's what all the stats say, is between 25 and 40. And the vast, vast, vast majority of people in Germany that are in development are men. It's a fact. And also we see that after 10 years, a lot of women exit STEM fields generally because discrimination and other things happening. So you have that intriguing mix of like, where are the seniors and how can we hire them and how much do we have to pay for them? But on the other hand, there's not a lot of willingness and maybe also not a lot of resources available due to that situation, or maybe that's what companies think, to mentor the juniors. What we did at SAP Signavio was we hired a cohort of juniors. And by the way, SAP generally as a company is very, very focused on hiring juniors through working student positions. And specifically at Signavio, when we weren't yet SAP, because we were in the process of transitioning into SAP, we thought about how can we make that happen? Because the years prior, we had hired quite a high number of seniors. That being said, just because you are a senior, that does not necessarily mean that you have had any experience in mentoring others, because it might have not been expected from you in your previous position. Or you didn't just have the opportunity, you were interested in doing that, but you didn't have the opportunity, it didn't come around. Management, leadership also didn't create the opportunity. So we thought, okay, what can we do? And we set up a program where we had some, let's say, theoretical impulses for prospective mentors, like mentorship training, interview training, interview bias training, for example. And there was also a lot of work with the seniors that were going to be mentors. And then every junior, we had a handful of entry-level folks and then about, I think, 15 or 16 junior-level folks that we hired. Junior, in our definition, people that had some prior experience, like half a year working student or internship, something like that. And entry-level, starting just having some theoretical skills and then starting from scratch. So every person that came in that cohort, they had one or two mentors assigned to them in their respective team.
Wow, that sounds like an amazing resource.
And yeah, those mentors were supposed, or still are supposed to closely work with them, to pair with them frequently, to have sessions with them on any questions that they have, to guide them through challenges, etc. And in addition, by the way, to management and to what the tech lead provides. I did have a lot of individual coaching and training with the mentors as well to enable them to set them up for success in this. And also the juniors were super, super happy about that. Doesn't mean that they cannot pair with other people on the team. They should, actually. They definitely should pair with all the people on the team that they can pair with. But for them, this experience was very nourishing. In the very basic sense, they always had someone that they could talk to, and they had someone that was the person that was supposed to be there for them, right?
Yeah.
And also, of course, to be a mentor, you had to not only show interest, they also had to see a certain promise in that person, that they were going to be understanding and embracing and be open to establishing a coaching mindset, if not a toolkit of techniques, and just a lot of, you know, happiness about the outlook of being able to not only onboard, but to guide a junior through their journey of the first 1 to 2. Absolutely. So did everything go perfectly and smoothly? I wouldn't say that. We learned a lot in the process as well. But just the simple act of having that combination, I don't think a lot of companies do that. I think a lot of companies just throw people in the team. It's like, there you go. And then hope that they thrive. And if you're really like adamant about it and you insist on it, you will probably get the help that you need. But I do find it very valuable if management also, in the simplest terms, just...
I think as the key phrase there is being set up for success. I think that's like it's such a big deal, isn't it? It's not just being like, here's your job, here's your laptop, Good luck.
Yeah, the problem really though is just like finding companies that have the resource to allocate to providing mentors. And like from a coding web dev perspective, if you can find a company that has like a mentoring program, you know, like a junior program, this is really valuable. But again, it comes back to that, what we were talking about earlier, this like beggars and choosers thing, you know, do you take the job you can get or do you take the job that has all of these, you know, amazing resources? Like if I was doing a junior dev interview and they're like, look, we have 1 to 2 mentors per junior, you know, and we're committed to our newcomers learning and stuff. It would be, you just kind of dive on that opportunity to be mentored through or helped, especially through those early stages of your first tech job.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
We are kind of getting to the end of the interview now. But I think what you've said so far has been unbelievably useful and very like information dense. Is there anything else you think, oh, you know, I wish that, you know, I could tell every junior this fact?
Tons of advice.
Yeah. Big question.
We have 8 more hours.
What's your top tip?
No, but that's usually when you are at a certain stage in your career. And I didn't have a technical career, but of course, hiring for those positions that. But I still have my experiences and I had that, you know, here's your laptop, go experience, just to underline that. So I know the pain that you feel when you are in that situation. So most importantly is, what is your North Star? What is your mission? It's individual for you and your journey. If somebody tells you, oh, that company and this person and that track and that journey is perfect for you, your path is the right path for you. And to know what is the right path for you, talk to people. Go out there, network, ask them what it's like, what is the reality, how is the experience for people. And I think that is very, very valuable just to have that information. And then you can think about that, you can digest that, and you can come to your own conclusions. And there are a lot of people out there that will be like, don't give up and push through in the first couple of years. I agree to a certain, in a certain sense, because we have seen that even with very strong mentorship, there are hurdles and there can be moments where you're like, oh, I haven't yet learned that. And something else is popping up and how do I handle that? Yeah, we see that happens. But again, that level of companionship, be that from someone who is more senior than you or who is even a peer, we've seen that as well, that in our cohort, people that banded together, right? Oh, let's learn that together, and you're going through the same thing. Your tech lead, my tech lead, my leads told me, your leads told. So it's that shared experience. I think that helps through a lot of difficult moments and challenges. And I would give that advice to anyone, because having a peer group is generally valuable. And also, they generally say you stick around in a job, particularly through the challenging times, when you have somebody to complain with. So that shared experience of, oh, let's celebrate this is important, but it's also important to be like, oh, not that again, you know, oh, yeah. And this person is just going on my nerves. Sometimes it's good to just have an outlet, right? And to be able to share in those lived experiences. And then once you have let it out, you can have a positive outlook again and you move on. And that is what I would say is that resilience we are all talking about. It's not like you go there and you know everything, you can do everything and you're just so strong. No, you have a challenging experience, you get up again, another challenging experience, you get up again, and you have people that support you through that and that you support through their challenge. So I think those are the two bits of advice or input that I would give people that are in the first years of their career, career changers, graduates, etc. Because humanity, community, that's essential. That's what makes us people.
Nice.
Good. Well said. Tell each other stories around the fire.
Francesca, thank you so much for your time, and that was wonderful advice. Well, there you go. Awesome. Really good advice.
I wish that we were making this podcast when we were students.
I mean, that's why we made it though, right? Because there's so much unknown information out there.
And
as soon as you get speaking to people, it becomes very clear. Especially this like golden, absolutely golden, somehow still overlooked and underused thing, and that is the network. of people that you meet, specifically when you come out of IronHack, the alumni group that you get is really valuable.
Yeah.
And then just going to meetups, the actual act of going to networking events is just in itself very, very, very useful. And I think that was some really good advice you gave.
Well, it was, I think it was really interesting last week after we spoke to Sarah, seeing mm-hmm. when the podcast went out and the comments on the posts, you know, the posts and stuff, because she mentioned the network that she started when she graduated, and like, you know, people on her cohort commented, and she did her boot camp, what, like 6 or 7 years ago. So it just shows you how tight those bonds are. It's such an invaluable resource.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, I don't think, like, just to reiterate it, there is no better advice than to build the network around you and use that thing. And I mean, you can, you know, there's introverted and extroverted people, but there are ways to do it that isn't necessarily, you know, like taking everyone out for dinner, just like being in the room, you know, making the small effort of getting yourself in the room or maintaining these contacts really is the best way.
But that's what was cool about, I think, what Francisco was saying about the open source contributions as well. Even if you're not that comfortable, like even if you're mm-hmm. somehow you don't want to do the whole in-person networking or putting yourself out there, there's always a way of doing it. There's always a way of getting involved. And
yeah, open source, contributing to open source can also be quite like a quiet affair. You don't have to be like publicizing it. You can just add your code, put it up there, and people can see you. So all right, awesome. So I hope this episode was useful for you all. That's it. Have a wonderful day, weekend, evening, rest of your run, rest of the coffee, whatever you're doing while you're listening to this.
Yeah, and, rest of your knitting.
Yeah, we'll catch you on the other side.
See you in the next one.
Bye.